Thanks for joining us on the Port City Church podcast. More information about Port City Church is available at portcitychurch.org.
Good evening once again, and thanks for being here on the 4th of July weekend. And just so you know that I'm in the 4th of July spirit, y'all can see my America socks, right? So glad you guys have chosen to join us. A lot of folks come from out of town, and to take some time out of your weekend and spend it together is a really, really good thing. I trust, or I hope, as you read, and there it says, when's the last time you stopped and looked at your soul? And we're going to be talking about how to do that as we kind of conclude this series. And I'm so grateful for Clay and the message that he brought to us last week. If you were here, did y'all enjoy Clay? Yes, good. You can give him a hand too. I think Clay, is Clay in here tonight? He usually comes at 5. Somewhere. There he is, right there. Clay, you killed it last week. Thank you. And I always tell people, I told them this week, whenever people come to me and says, man, you better be careful because he's going to take your job. That is a huge compliment because it takes a lot of pressure off of me. Like, whoo, good. Because he can actually have it if he wants it. And so, but it's always a great compliment. It's always a great thing to hear that. And Clay talked about last week this idea that the average car on the road is 11.2 years old, and he has a car that's 12 years old. And do you remember this? And he talked about that how many of you have cars that are older than 12 years old? You're above average. And so I was in New Bern last Sunday morning. I saw it last Sunday night. But how many of you guys, just remind me, drive cars over 12 years old? Let me see your hands. All right, loud and proud. There we go. We like our old cars. Well, I own a car that is older than Clay. Actually, not quite, but it's pretty close. I have a car that was born in the 80s, go figure. It's a 1989 Volvo 740 GL station wagon. I've had the car for almost 18 years. I love this car. Now, it's not a fancy car, and in fact, for a long time, you get your tax in New Hanover County. They send you a tax bill. They assess your car value, and they tax you based on that value. And I think my car was worth like $1,000 or something like that. And so I'd pay like $13 a year for taxes on it. So I've had the car almost 18 years. I got it when we started the church. I've had the car almost 18 years, like $13 a year. And a few years ago, I got a tax bill, and I think I noticed it after I paid it. But I got a tax bill, it was like $129. And I remember going, why did I pay that much for that car? And then the next year it came back, it was like $135. And then I think this year it was like $160. And I look at this, I didn't really know this, but I looked at the assessment of my car, the value of my car on my tax assessment, and it's like $13,000. I'm like, have y'all seen my car? Like, how do you think my car is worth $13,000? And I found this out. This is what the city does to you, the county does to you. When your car turns 25, they just consider it an antique and jack the value way up. So that's what's happened to me. So my car's not worth near that much. But so I drive this car. I've had it. I love it. And Clay talked about the value of a good mechanic. And when I first bought this car, I did not have a good mechanic. And somewhere in the first couple of years, it started to show its age. It's got about 330,000 miles on it now. And we actually don't know how many it has because the odometer goes about 1 mile for every 20 miles you drive. So it's kind of weird. And the other idiosyncrasy, too, is like you can't tell how much gas is in the tank until you flick it. You got to flick the dashboard, and the gas needle will. It's kind of weird. So, but early on, when I first started driving this car, my windshield wipers didn't work very well. And what I mean by that is this. Whenever it started raining, you turn the windshield wipers on, they would make one complete cycle, and then they would just flip off the other side. So it's like, boom, 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 and then it's just like over, and it's just dangling over here off the side of your car. So you have to, you know, it always happens when it's like one of these summer storms, it just like rains out of nowhere, you turn the windshield wipers on, boom, boom, and then you can't see anything, and you pull over the side of the road and get out in the rain and fix your windshield wipers. And so I concocted a system, and what I would do is every time it would rain, I don't have air conditioning in my car either, so I would roll down the driver's side window about an inch and a half, and I would reach my hand out the window and wrap it around to the windshield, and so that when the windshield wipers, when I turn them on, they would go out, they would hit my fingertips and then go back the other way, keep them from flying off the edge. So just like, so I would be driving down the road on your streets like this, I was pouring down rain, and I got my hand out the window, stopping my windshield wipers, and I got water running down my arm and dripping into my lap, and that's how I did. And here's what happens every time. It would start to rain, and I would go, man, I forgot to fix my windshield wipers. I'd put them out there, turn it on, and drive like this. And then I'd be so mad. I can't believe I forgot to fix my windshield wipers. I swear I'll do this as soon as I get. Then you get somewhere, and it stops raining, and what happens? You forget about it. And guess when you remember it again? The next time it's raining. And this went on for probably a year. I don't know how long I drove around like this going, what kind of goofball am I? But every time, and I learned the value of a good mechanic. Someone who can actually peek around. Because here's what I think about a lot of us. The only time I remembered my windshield wipers were broken is when there was a problem. And for a lot of us, the only time we pay any attention to the condition of our hearts is when there's a problem. And what I've learned about my car is if you pay attention to some small things over time, it can really help it fulfill the purpose with which it is intended. I have a mechanic. I have a great mechanic. Clay talked about having a great mechanic. I have a great mechanic. We are great friends. He has made it his life's mission to make sure that my car runs, and he is doing a great job on it. In fact, my car is in the shop right now, ironically enough. And so I'll call him and say, hey, I'm bringing my car in for an oil change. And that's like code for, hey, man, can you really look at my car and make sure it's going to run some more? And so he does the oil change, and he drives around, and he looks at it, and he calls me and says, hey, Mike, I think it's good. He looks it over and makes some other things that may need to be adjusted. He just takes some time to really delve in and look at what's really going on with it and says, okay, now it's ready for the next season. This is a good thing to do for your car. It's a better thing to do for your heart. You see, what we're about to do is we're going to ask you to kind of do the same thing. We're going to talk about this idea of a personal retreat. Of taking a personal retreat. See, last year in December, we did a series about finishing well, and we talked about finishing the year well and having a personal retreat, taking 2 hours out of that week between Christmas and New Year's, and spend some time with God doing a personal retreat. You can download it off our website. It's got some questions, some Bible verses, some journal prompts to help you sort of look and see what's the condition underneath the hood, underneath the surface of your life. And I'll tell you, I don't know how many people did it. We had probably 700-800 people download the retreat last year, and the comments and emails and stories we get back from this are, oh my gosh, this changed my life. Oh my gosh, this was so good. And I know a lot of people don't do it or won't do it, but I'm telling you, it might be the thing that prepares you for the next season of your life. In fact, all of you probably started your year with some kind of resolution. If you've been around Port City long enough, we don't pick New Year's resolutions, we pick words. And it's a word, we use a word as a lens to help us see and hope and identify what God is doing in us over there and say, God, this is the kind of person I want to become over the next 12 months. Help me to see this. And you picked a word and you started off with all this hope and now you're 6 months in and you're like, you know, this is halfway through the year. You're halfway through the year and you're like, I can't remember what my word was. You know what? That's okay. Go get your journal out, look it up and start somewhere because you know what you'll do otherwise? You go, well, I'll just wait till next year. That's 6 whole months. 6 whole months when you can be doing something. Imagine what your life might be like in December if you did something today about the thing that's bothering you, about the thing that's struggling you, about the thing that you're looking at that you can't figure out how to make hide nor hair of. What if you did something about that over the next few weeks and months? How differently might your life look by the end of this year? Don't let this time go by. And I want to encourage you, just like I do with my mechanic, hey man, can you take a look at what's under the hood and see if this car is ready for the next season? I want you to take some time over the next month and spend some time taking a personal retreat. Download it. Just say, you know, maybe you don't know what you're doing. We'll walk you through the whole thing. To see what's underneath the hood of your head, of your heart, to prepare you for the next season of your life. It might be the best 2 hours that you spend. It might be the most significant 2 hours that you spend in the next month. And we're going to talk more about that as we close. A lot of people, and Clay taught this last week, he talked about self-assessment and self-awareness. And a lot of people talk about self-assessment and self-awareness. It's a lot of buzzwords today in culture. And what most people are trying to do is to figure out how to be more aware of themselves or how to assess themselves better so they can just be better people. And if we're honest, our attempts to be better people are really just so that we're not very annoying to other people. That's the way most of our motives for change. You show up at church because you want to be different. You're like, God, can you change me enough so I'm not annoying to my wife? Or God, can you change me enough so I'm not annoying to my husband? Or God, can you change me enough so I don't annoy my kids or my parents? We want God to change us, but we only want him to change us enough so we can kind of do what we want to do. God has a much more radical vision for your life than that. He wants to do something in you so deep and so real and so radically life-altering. And we want to posture ourselves. This is what he's called and created us to do. And self-awareness and self-assessment are critical to that. What I want, our goal, my vision for this is for us to have as a church a self-assessment culture within a trusted community. To have a culture where we're all aware of where we are and how we're living within the trusted context of community, the context of trusted community, people that we live life with, people that we know and we trust and that know us and trust us. And Clay taught this last week. He said this. He said that self-awareness without self-assessment is harmful and dangerous. If you know that you're a hothead, or you know that you're prone to sort of shave the truth, or you know that you're prone to certain behaviors that are damaging, and you don't do anything about it, you are destroying the relationships that you live within. And on the flip side, that self-assessment without self-awareness is pretty much useless. You're assessing yourself, but you don't have any idea of where you stand in that. What I want for you to understand is that self-assessment is not just about you and how you're doing. It's not about you getting better or about you changing enough not to be annoying the people that are around you. Self-assessment is about knowing where you are in relationship to what is going on around you. Self-assessment is about knowing where you are in relation to what is going on around you, because oftentimes, if you're like me, the circumstances that happen to you can throw you for a loop. And you go, what just happened? And we're talking about, how do you know where you are in relation to what is going on around you? And more importantly, what God is doing in you, where you are in relation to what is going on around you. Your impact and your influence on other people, you've got to pay attention to, but it's not just about your influence or your impact. It's about His image. If you've been made to bear the image of God, then how you represent Him in every situation, every circumstance, is of utmost importance. Clay did this last week, and one of the things we talk about around here is sort of the framework that we use for transformation, for spiritual formation. We use the idea of encounter, formation, expression. And I abbreviate it because it's faster. I think you get that. But encounter, formation, expression. If you've been here, you know what this is. If you haven't, you have no idea what I'm talking about. Basically, the premise is that everybody has an encounter, something that has happened to them, something that they have seen, observed, or experienced, an encounter, a collision. And what that does, whatever that is, it affects the condition of your heart. It changes something about who you are at the core of your life. And that your life, the behaviors and the actions of your life, are basically expressions of the condition of your insides. So for example, if you grew up and you had a family structure where it was very tenuous and you couldn't really depend on it, and there was a lot of distrust and maybe a lot of instability, and you learned early on that the only person you can trust is yourself, something happened to your heart. And guess what? The odds are that in all of your relationships, you find it very difficult to trust other people. You tend to be very guarded. You tend to hold your heart very close to you and keep people at a distance to you. Why? Because of what you have seen. If you tend to explode, if there's a hotheadedness to you, it's probably because of something that has happened. I mean, all of these things come out of us from what the condition of our heart is. And what most of us do is we try to work on all of our behaviors over here. I'm just going to not yell. I'm going to be nice. I'm going to tell the truth. I'm going to not lie anymore. I'm not going to look at things on the internet. Whatever it is, behavior you're trying to correct, we always focus over here. And almost all the time, this has to do, when we focus on it over on this side, it almost always has to do with how other people perceive us. God, change me enough not to be annoying to other people. Change me enough that I can get along. Change me enough that I do well in my job. Change me enough that I do well in my family. Change me enough that I do well in my marriage. Change me enough that I do well in my school, whatever that might be. And what it winds up being is sort of centering on these two concepts. And number one is the idea of impression, how other people perceive us. How are people going to like me or approve of me if I do this or if I do that? How do other people perceive me? What is the impression other people have of me? And just real quick, I don't want you to, you know, Rachel, but in your mind, do a quick survey. How much of your lives are spent on making sure that we look like other people expect us to look? Make sure that we behave the way other people expect us to behave. And it's just this pressure that we live under. The second thing, that when this begins to sort of become our mindset, then what happens is everything that stands in the way, every circumstance that happens to us that we wish didn't happen, or everything that we want that we didn't get, or everything that happened that we wish wouldn't have, it becomes a problem to be solved, and our drive becomes to find solutions to those problems. Even your prayers are solutions to problems. God, fix this. Fix this. So last week, and I love the way Clay walked through Psalm 139. And I took the challenge and I sat down in my journal, and I wrote down the prayer from Psalm 139. God, search me and know me and see if there is any offensive way that is in me. Do you know how long it took God to answer that prayer? God, search me and know me and see if there's anything in me that's disappointing to you. I didn't even finish it. I didn't finish the prayer. I was like, oh, there it is. You could have waited a little while to answer that prayer. I was in the service last week, and as soon as I said, God, search me and know me, he's like, there you go. I'm like, oh, I don't need this right now. But I took it seriously, and I sat down, and I just did this prayer every week, and I wrote down the two things that he told us, the two things that he taught us. He said that God knows us fully, and he loves us completely. And I wrote that in my journal. God, you know me fully, and you love me completely. What a freeing thing to think about. That when God said, God, search me and know me, he's not going, oh, I didn't know you thought that. He's like already there. God, search me and know me and see if there's anything in me. And it just and you love me just like that. You don't expect me to be any different. You love me just like I am. And it was just freeing to be able to let him do that. The second statement, and when he said it in the service, it brought tears to my eyes because it says, God pursues me perfectly. God pursues you perfectly. I mean, think about how most of us think. If you've got work to do on your character, what most of us do is we go, okay, when I get right, then God will be able to use me. When I finally get behind, when I get this problem behind me, then God will be able to use me. When I get this problem solved, when you fix this problem, then you'll be able to use me. It's like when we get somewhere or get something right, then we'll be useful to God, or God will be able to do something with us. And it's like, no, he pursues you right where you are, just like you are, and he does it perfectly. And the reality is you don't have to wait to get somewhere else other than where you are. And that's the courage that I want for you to have in this whole thing. I want for you to think like that. You see, an honest assessment of ourselves requires an authentic encounter with God. That's what Clay left us with last week. If you want to know who you really are, you cannot do it apart from really bringing yourself before him. And then he gave us some tools last week to do. Use the prayer, use your Bible, a pen, a journal, and see what God says or does. And so that's what I did. And so I'm reading through, one of my disciplines for the summer is I'm reading the Psalms, and I have it titled in my journal, Slowly Through Psalms. Do you know why I've titled it Slowly Through Psalms? Because I'm reading slowly through Psalms. I know, it's like, oh, mind-blowing. Spiritual disciplines for like really profound people. Because what happens is we go, I'm going to take a book and I'm going to read the whole thing in like 30 days or 90 days or whatever. I'm like, no, I'm just going to read the Psalms. In fact, I've been doing this for several months, and I've been in the 80s, Psalm 80s, for the last longer than I should be. And so I told Rick last week, I said, man, I'm reading Psalm 86, one of our pastors. I'm reading Psalm 86. And Rick said, Mike, you're stuck in the 80s. I said, in more ways than you can imagine. But Psalm 86, and I just keep reading it over and over. And here's what it says. Look at this. This is what kind of jumped out at me. Psalm 86, 11, it says, teach me, Lord, your ways. Teach me your ways that I may rely on your faithfulness. I mean, look at this. Teach me your way, Lord, that I may rely on your faithfulness. Now, I know what we do. I mean, you're like me. We sit and read the Bible when we read it, right? And we get all excited. Oh, man, that's a good one. I'm going to underline that. Teach me. I may even tweet that out. Teach me to rely. Teach me your ways that I may rely on your faithfulness. And we don't really stop and think about the implications. Because think about this. When you're learning to drive, right? I have a kid who just got her driver's license. When she was 15 and she was learning to drive, she says, Dad, teach me your ways, oh, Dad. Teach me the wonderful driving ways that you have for me. Why? So that I could sit in the passenger seat with her for the rest of her life? Oh, no. She said, teach me your ways so you don't have to ride with me anymore. I mean, we have a whole philosophy built around this, right? Catch a man a fish, feed him for a day. Teach a man to fish, and he will never need you for anything ever again. Until you read this, and that's not what it says at all. Teach me your ways, God, that I can solve and get on with my life. And he says, oh, no. I'll teach you my ways. I'm going to teach you my ways so that you can learn to be dependent on me. You can learn to. Don't we ask God to put us in situations where we don't have to depend on him? God, if you'll just fix this, I promise I'll be good. He's like, I don't want you to be good. I want you to trust me. I'm going to put you in a situation where there's uncertainty. I mean, you're not sure. And where the only thing you can do is depend on me and trust in me, because that's what I'm doing in your life. That's what his ways look like. This is a radically different way of thinking about this. And it requires something more than just kind of reading through. It requires something that we do and live this out. And it really requires us to live this out in community. In fact, I want to show you something that I used. And I'm grateful. I'm indebted to Henry Cloud for teaching this. And it's taken about 5 years for it to sort of sink in. But it might be the most profound thing that I've learned in the last 5 years. He records this in a book called The Power of the Other. But I'll give you a quick synopsis of it. I used this in a series that we did called Handle with Care a few months ago. And it talks about our relationships. And he divides our relationships into these four quadrants. And in quadrant number one, he says, the basic assumption is that every human being is wired for connection. Every human being is wired to connect with another human being. It starts when you come out of the womb and you're like, can somebody please feed me and hold me? You're trying to connect with somebody. And it does not stop. Every human being is wired innately to connect with another person. And we're all looking for this. And for some of you, when things have happened that allow you or cause you not to connect well, what happens is you begin to use this. You base your connections with people on how well you're liked or how effective you are, how good you are at getting things done, how well you perform. And so our whole lives are built on these kind of relationships with other people, trying to connect at an authentic level. And it never works. And here's why. He says this first quadrant over here is the quadrant where we have no connection. We have no connection. The dominant emotion here is that you are lonely, that you feel alone. Now, if you over here in no connection land, no connection quadrant, it doesn't mean you don't have friends or acquaintances or a junkload of people, followers on Facebook. What it does mean is that no one really knows you. I did a funeral for a guy about 15 years ago or so. I met with him. He was he was mid-50s, maybe late 50s. He'd been retired for a while. And he had been playing golf with the same group of men for 20 years. And he died unexpectedly. I went over and met with all his golf friends. And I said, tell me about your friend. He's like, his shoots in the low 80s. 20 years of playing golf. And they didn't know anything more about him than his golf score. That's no connection. It's no connection. The dominant emotion here, you could say, is depression. Quadrant two is the quadrant that we'll call bad connections, or Henry Cloud calls bad connections. And again, these aren't just that they're bad in terms of like, oh, good or bad. It means that there's something that's not healthy about them. In other words, this is based on performance. It's based on how well you do, how well you perform, how good you are or bad you are. When you perform well, you're well-liked. When you don't perform well, you're not well-liked. This happens in codependent relationships. It happens in relationships of where there are domestic issues. Because these are all about, if you do something well, you sort of get you get some good things to happen. If you don't do things well, then you get punished for it. Marriages exist in this relationship. It's all about this exchange. If she's nice, then I'll be nice. If you do this, then I'll do that. And we live in this exchange. So if you grew up like this, if you made good grades, if you performed well on a sports team, you were in good grace with your parents. But if you didn't, Lord knows, it was going to be bad. And the dominant sort of theme here is pressure. And the dominant emotion is anxiety. Does this look familiar to anybody? The third quadrant is what he calls the pseudo connection. And this is where we might actually experience a little bit of joy. We might go, oh, that feels good. And this is sort of marked by the temporary nature of this. In other words, we can get relief for a moment, but then it's back to whatever it was we lived in before. And sort of the dominant problem here is that of addiction. And this isn't just like addicted to drugs or alcohol. This is, I'm going to work. Because you see what happens. They don't have any connections here. I try to pursue some connections, and they're bad connections. And so one way I'm depressed, the other way I get over here, and all it is anxiety, and I go back and forth. And when you get tired of that, you get on here and you chase something else, some kind of form of escape, some way to get away from it. And you realize that doesn't work, and so you just go back and you ping pong back and forth, and you wonder why depression, anxiety, and addictions are run rampant in our culture. It's because we don't know how to connect with other people. So he talks about this fourth area right here. And he calls this the real connection. And interestingly enough, this isn't a connection that is made because you have it all together and you connect with someone else who has it all together. And they studied this. They said the thing that determines a real connection between two human beings, listen to this, this is amazing. The thing that determines an authentic connection between two human beings is that they are known fully and loved completely. Sound familiar? Do you know why? Because the relationships that we have with each other are designed to be expressions of the relationship that we have with God. Nothing else will ever do. No amount of effort to be better, no amount of effort to withdraw, no amount of effort to escape will ever replace what you and I have been made for. So how do we do this? We're going to about to hit it in overdrive and go really fast. Are y'all ready? Galatians chapter 6. Whenever I read the Bible, a lot of times I'll read it from, my favorite version is probably the New International Version, NIV, which a lot of you own, or an ESV or something like that. So I'm familiar with those, and Galatians 6 is this, hey, if anybody's caught in sin, restore them gently, but watch yourself so you don't fall into sin as well. And then it has this coupling in there, and it says, in one part it says, carry each other's burdens, and in doing so, you'll fulfill the law of Christ. And then just a couple verses later, it says, but each person should carry their own load. And then it says, and those of you who are doing this, you're supposed to like contribute back. And it's kind of hard to understand. And whenever I get passages like that I'm either really familiar with or just need to change my thinking on them, I read from a different translation. So I'm going to read to you from this translation of the Bible called The Message. This is Galatians chapter 6, verses 4 through 6. It says, make a careful exploration of who you are and the work that you have been given, and then sink yourself into that. Make careful exploration of who you are and the work that you have been given, and sink yourself into that. And you go, well, I don't really know how to make a careful exploration of myself. I do. Let me tell you how. Take a personal retreat. Like, shameless plug. This is, so everybody in there put themselves in one of these categories when I mention this. You've already self-assessed. Make careful exploration of yourself and the work that you've been given, and sink yourself into that. You know, this is not easy work and this is not quick work, but this might be the most important work that you can do. And what I'm encouraging you to do is to take some time and go make careful exploration of yourself. Take some time, take 2 hours over the next month. We will facilitate every part of this for you to help you with this. He goes and he says, don't be impressed with yourself. Like, this is like, oh, mirror selfies. Like, don't be impressed with yourself. It doesn't mean that you need to have a bad self-esteem. It just means don't be overly impressed with yourself. I mean, my youth minister that I grew up under, he told me, he said, Mike, don't believe your press. Because people who write good things about you don't know you. And people who write bad things about you don't know you. So don't even check it out. Don't even pay attention to it. Don't be too impressed with those. You just live your life out before God. And then he goes on, he says this. Do not compare yourself with others. We could do a whole series on that, right? Don't compare yourself with other people. But how many of us do this? Well, his wife doesn't do that, or her husband doesn't do this, or their kids are doing this, or their kids. Do you know how many AP classes their kids are taking? Like, can you believe that? And we're always kind of comparing. Don't do it. Don't compare yourself with other people. Each person, you and me, must take responsibility for doing the creative best you can with your own life. I love this last phrase. Each one of us must take responsibility for doing the creative best we can with our own lives. You know why I love this? Because all of us are not just naturally talented, and it takes a little creativity for us to find our best, right? I love this. But you gotta do the work on this. He goes on, he says, be very sure now that you who have been trained to a self-sufficient maturity, that you enter into a generous common life with those who trained you, sharing all the good things that you have and that you have in experience. There were three things in this that kind of made me go, oh, that's really interesting. Thing number one was this idea of self-sufficient maturity. Like, what is self-sufficient maturity? What is that, and how does that relate to what we spent the few weeks talking about self-sufficiency as a bad thing in Mad World? And this is what I think it means. There's an old writer, a youth group guru named Bill Jones, and his whole mode when he was helping people walk with God, talking about discipleship, he said, the goal of discipleship is for you and I to become independently dependent upon Jesus Christ. The goal is for you and I to become independently dependent upon Jesus Christ. That's a great statement. I think that's what it means. That we can say, God, teach me your ways that I might rely on you. That's what I think that idea is. The second thing was this idea of a generous common life. And what is a generous common life? Because it's telling us that all of us need to enter into this generous common life, not when you get to where you need to be, but from right where you are, to enter into a generous common life. Great phrase. The idea is that we contribute to what is going on. We bring ourselves, our stories, our lives, not to impress each other, but rather to express God's image, his love and his grace and his character in every situation that we face. Again, self-assessment isn't just knowing where you are, but knowing where you are in relation to what is going on, and more importantly, knowing what God is doing. This is so important. So there are three things that I want you to do. Actually, there are four. This is how the Hebrews writer said this. So there are six things the Lord hates. Yea, there are seven. So I'm using the same thing. There are three things I want you to do. Yea, there are four. The first is this. The first is I want for you to avail yourself to another. I don't mean just show up. I don't mean go, I got friends. I mean to avail yourself, to make yourself available. You see, as I was thinking about this, the best way to express God's work is to share it. The best way for you to understand, to find out what God is doing in you, what he's doing in the world around you, is to share that with another person, and you have to avail yourself to them in that. I want to ask you a question. Who knows you? And men are way worse than this than women. I mean, I told you the golf story. Who knows something more about you than your golf score or what kind of waves you like? Who knows you? Who knows what you think and what you worry about? Who knows what you're concerned about? Who knows what you're afraid of? Who knows what you wish would happen? Who knows you? Do you have people in your life? Can you write a name on an index card of the person that knows you? Go avail yourself to someone. This is kind of the beauty of why, like, I know people, when you're talking about counseling and people needing other people in there, what you're doing is you're availing yourself to understand what God is doing in the world around you, to assess where you are in light of what is happening around you or what you've been through. These are important skills that we need, and we need other people in our lives to help us do this. Avail yourselves to others. That's the first thing you gotta do. If you wanna understand and know what God's doing, don't go sit in your room and try to figure it out. Go talk to someone that you trust, that knows you and likes you anyway. That's a great thing. There are people in my life that know me and they like me anyway. That's a great thing. Authentic encounters require authentic people. That's what we've got to be. We've got to be, learn to live down here. So last two things, or three things I want to tell you. Number one is, instead of thinking solution, even in your prayers, God, if you'll just fix this problem, if you'll just solve this, fix this, do this. God, if you'll just fix my finances, you'll fix my relationships, you'll fix my kids. Everything's about a solution to a problem. What I want you to understand is God has never promised to solve all of your problems. What he has promised is to redeem them, to take that which was meant for bad and cause it to be useful for good. And the challenge is to think redemption, not solution. Solution is, when this gets fixed, then I'll be good. Redemption is, I'm waiting and watching and walking as God redeems whatever circumstance you find yourselves in. Think about it. Look at the end of this verse. In Galatians chapter 6, it says this. I want to put that back up there. He says, I want you to enter into this generous common life, and I want you to share all the good things that you have in experience. Share all the good things you have. And most of you are going, oh, man, all the good things. I got a nice house. I can cook. I can do some things really good. I got a cool 89 Volvo if you like riding without air conditioner. I can share the good things that I have. And most of the, when we think about the good things, we think about things that have turned out well, the outcomes have been good, or the circumstances are good. And I want to ask you, how do you think God sees good? Romans 1:28 says this, right? We know that God works all things together for good for those who are called, who love him and are called according to his purpose. That God works all things together for good. When you think redemptively, see over here, think solutions, good is problem solved. Thinking redemptively is very different. Good is that it remains in the hand, in God's redemptive hand. Instead of figuring out that something's been solved, you just know that it exists in God's redemptive hand, and that's what makes it good, because he's working it out. It allows you to stay in process. It allows you to live in uncertainty. It allows you to say, God, teach me your ways that I might continue to depend on you. So that's thing two. Thing one, avail yourself. Thing two, think redemption, not solution. And thing three is think expression, not impression. My goal is to change what you see. If you change what you see, you're going to change what you do. It's going to happen. To think expression, what I mean is instead of thinking, how are other people going to think of me? What kind of impression am I going to leave on other people? You think, how am I going to express God's heart to them? How different is that? I mean, most of the time we meet someone, what did they think about me? Was it, did I have something on my nose? We're so consumed with how people thought of us, and we spend very little time thinking about how do they think of God because of their encounter with me. If you want to understand what God is doing, if you're talking about self-assessment in light of where you are, in light of what is going on around you, you've got to begin to see what God is doing in you and through you, and it requires you to see things differently. Some of you spend all of your time, God, fix this, God, do this. If you'll just change this, I promise I'll never do this. And you keep doing the same thing, and you wonder why, because you don't see anything any differently. But if you spent 5 days or 5 months seeing the world differently, I got a strong feeling at the end of that time, you're going to be different. This is why what I'm talking about, because I believe that what God wants to do, we want a culture where we're constantly saying, God, what are you doing in my life? What are you doing through my life? What are you doing through us together? A self-assessment culture within trusted community. Not so we'll just get better and go, look how moral we are, look how good we are. So people will look at us and go, oh my gosh, that is what God's heart looks like. That's the goal. God hasn't called us together to be more effective, to be more efficient, to get things done at a quicker pace. He's called us together so the world will see and know his heart through our lives at work together. The relationships that we have, that we live in, that get expressed, that will ultimately reveal his heart to the world. And it doesn't really matter any other stuff behind that. So what I'm going to ask you this is thing four, and you know what it is. Spend some time and take the personal retreat. Like, can I say it any stronger? Right? So what I want you to do, no, you can answer me. What I want you to do, take a personal retreat. I'm telling you, you will not regret it. God, teach me your ways that I can rely on you. What a prayer. Let's pray together. God, I just ask that you would meet us. I mean, just like Clay talked about last week, you have pursued us perfectly. Every person here tonight, every person watching online, every person that watches this, you've heard, you have pursued them right here, right now. God, I ask that we would courageously follow, availing ourselves to you and availing ourselves to a trusted other, that we would begin to see and think about your redemptive plan for our lives and not just how you can solve our problems, that we would begin to think and understand or be concerned with how your heart gets seen from our lives instead of how others perceive our lives. God, change what we see, that we might see you, an authentic encounter with you. That's my hope, that's my prayer, and that would translate in to an authentic expression of your heart through us. God, use us to that end, and I thank you for your goodness toward us in it, and I ask this name of your son, Jesus, amen.